Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 165 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. This week's episode is sponsored by Movement Watches. Now, many of you have probably not heard of Movement, but they are a watch company that was actually started by two quote-unquote broke college kids that wanted to wear stylish watches but couldn't afford them. So they started their own watch company.
Yes, they did. And can I say that Summer and I were both lucky enough to get one, to select one. And they are gorgeous. They are gorgeous. They're very classy and classic. The one I chose was called Venice. Now, I looked at them and I got it down to two choices. I thought, okay, do I want silver? Because silver is my metal color of choice that I go with any jewelry. And then the rose gold. It's so pretty. And I just love the hue and the way it looked against almost actually any skin color. But then I talked to some and some's like, well, do what you want, but silver will literally go with everything that you have because that's all you wear. And I'm like, okay, makes sense. So I got a silver one. Oh my gosh. So pretty. I wear it every day to work. Everyone who sees it loves it. And just really comments on it. It really is a talking piece. I don't have to say much. I don't have to say anything. I just, you know, put my hand down to do whatever. And people are like, what is that? And then we talk about it. It's very shiny, you know, because it's silver. It's just very eye-catching. It's so pretty.
Well, I like to say that these watches are actually, you say classic. I like to say timeless. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is because if you look at, you know, the history of watches, the watches that were around 100 years ago, those styles still exist today. And if you look back at like the 80s when Swatch watches were real, real popular, I don't know if you remember those. They were like giant, giant faces, plastic looking, and it was a very stylized look, but nobody wears them anymore. But if you look back at the classic pieces that have been out for hundreds of years, they still survive today and people still wear them and they're still eye-catching and they still go with all of today's fashion. And these are in that vein of a timeless piece that, you know, it's stylish today. It was stylish probably 50, 60, 100 years ago, and it's probably still going to be stylish 150 years from now.
Now, how can we tie in, you may ask, dear listener, a sponsor that sells fine watches and a podcast that talks about Outlander? Well, one word, time. Outlander is a story we all love, and at its heart, everything happened because of time travel.
If I was going to go back through the stones today, I wouldn't take my cell phone with me. It wouldn't work. But what I would need and what might come in handy is an actual watch.
That's true. Now, Movement watches start at just $95. Now, at a department store, you're looking at like $400 to $500. And see, Movement figured out that by selling online, they were able to cut out the middleman and retail markup, providing the best possible price. So get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to mvmtwatches.com/Outlander. Now, as Summer said, this watch really has a clean design. Now, seriously, like I said, I've been getting compliments ever since I put it on, and I've only been wearing it for a week or three. I guess that's two. So now is the time to step up your watch game. Go to mvmtwatches.com/Outlander.
Join the movement. So announcements this week. The Scottish BAFTAs announced their nominations for the 2016 Scottish BAFTA Awards. And nominated was one Miss Katrina Balfe, one Mr. Sam Heughan, and the show Outlander were all nominated for 2016 Scottish BAFTA Awards.
This is pretty cool because since they really didn't get Jack Diddle Squat at the Emmys and, well, no, it's not. Well, they didn't get anything, but they did get two nominations, one for set design, right? And one for costume, I think. Mm-hmm. There were two nominations that he didn't get any awards, but at least they got a nomination. Yeah. So there's a whole lot of conversation, a whole lot of tweeting that goes on when involving awards shows and nominations and everything. And we totally get it. We can't possibly cover everything, but that is there if you guys want to go read it. And of course, we always suggest going to read our friend of the show site, OutlanderTVNews.com. And they write up everything there. So yeah. So, but congratulations to everyone. That is hopefully the first of many, probably the first of many.
Read-along. This week we are discussing chapter 10 from Voyager, entitled White Witch's Curse.
Jamie is back at Ardsmuir, freezing. He's alone in an empty storeroom. He missed being with the other men, for their company, but mostly for their warmth. He's basically in solitary. Now he thinks he won't be returned to the cell with the other men until they've punished him for escaping. He is afraid of being flogged, but he hopes that flogging is actually his punishment that he gets. It would be bad, but it would be over with quickly. Eileen P. writes, "We get a horrible glimpse of Jamie's existence in prison when he hopes he will be flogged rather than enduring being put back in irons. He is already restricted by the walls of the prison. To have his body restricted is unbearable." Joe B. writes, "Jamie Fraser has escaped. Easy enough to do, but Lord John, in his anger, is astute enough to realize that there is a reason for it." Lisa T. writes, "We know that Jamie has been flogged on several occasions, and so we understand his fear and dread." And Jamie feels the rosary around his neck and begins to say a Hail Mary. He has indeed kept his word to Lord John. What wasn't part of the bargain was that he tell them he knew the man, that wanderer, or what conclusions he drew from his words. He had recognized Duncan Kerr immediately. Duncan had been a taxman of Colin McKenzie, and then after Culloden, he'd escaped to France. And Jamie warned Duncan that whatever he said would be told to Lord John. Duncan's speech wandered. He was all over the place. Now he tells Jamie that the gold is cursed. Quote, "It was given by the White Witch, given for the king's son. But the cause is lost, and the king's son fled, and she will not let the gold be given to a coward." Unquote. Jamie asks who the White Witch is. Duncan replies, quote, "She seeks a brave man, a Mackenzie. It is for himself. Mackenzie, it is theirs. She says it for the sake of him who is dead." Unquote. Jamie asks again who the White Witch is. Duncan says it was a witch, a wise woman, a white lady. Now Claire, we know, had been called all of that. Again, he asks Duncan who the witch was. Duncan replies, "The witch. The witch. She is a soul eater. She is death. He is dead, the Mackenzie. He is dead." Unquote. Duncan cries out that they are all dead, Colm, Dougal, and Ellen. And we learn that people had said that when Jamie's mom, Ellen, had left Leach to be with Brian Fraser and eventually marry him, that she'd left to be with the Silky. Now John comes over and asks the man in French where the gold is. He's getting frustrated, and he's realizing the man's about to die. It's like, we need to hear this now. Jamie warns Duncan with a fist squeeze that, be careful, you know, be careful what you say. Mm-hmm. He is raving with fever.
Doesn't he whisper to him at one point, "Everything I say will be repeated to the English"?
Yeah, I already said that.
Okay.
John demands that he speak to them and tell them where the gold is. Duncan's eyes flew open and he said, "She will tell you. She will come for you." And then, quote, "for both of you," unquote. And then he dies. Diana writes, quote, "The guardianship of the gold had passed," unquote. Now, Martina P. writes, "I am aware there will be a lot of symbolism research in regards to the rambling of Duncan, the description and location of the treasure. Can't wait to find out, Ginger." Sorry, Martina. I didn't do any of that.
Oh, you're fired.
I have nothing. What was there? There were no plants.
You only look up plants?
I only
that is your thing.
I only consistently look up plants. No, I'll look up, you know, religious symbolism. I did do a little search for Saint Bride and White Lady and that kind of thing, but seriously, like the top like three pages of hits are Outlander scattered through all of it. I'm like, I'm not going to look at an Outlander site. I know what Outlander says. We just read it. So I'm so sorry, Martina. I am honored that you were looking forward to it, but I am very sorry to disappoint you. There wasn't, I mean, Heather was mentioned, the White Lady. So there wasn't much for me to do. And if I missed something, then let me know. Anyone let me know if there was something that we could have, inserted. Martina continues, I was quite surprised that Jamie and Duncan were kinsmen being so far away from home. Also, Jamie's mother, Ellen Mackenzie, must have been one impressive woman. The references made to her throughout the books make me quite curious about her, and I would love to see a painting of this popular lady. So Jamie had kept his oath to John and escaped when he could in order to do what he could with Duncan's legacy. Jamie is pulled out of the storeroom and dragged to Lord John's quarters. The guard who takes him says, quote, and may God have mercy on your soul, MacDoof, unquote. Jamie, of course, refuses to tell Lord John where he's been or why he left. Now, he was in Lord John's private sitting room, not in his office. Now, Lord John says, have you any notion what I could do to you for this? And of course, Jamie knows very well. John raises his voice at Jamie to come stand in front of him. And Jamie says, quote, I am not a dog, Major. You'll do as you like with me, but I'll not come when you call me to heal, unquote. Methinks that he's resigned himself to physical punishment, but not only his age, experience, and dignity, but also his experience with BJR in Wentworth, the ordering about, being treated like a dog, etc., surely has had an effect on him. And here, there's no Claire to save. She's gone, so he can demand his dignity here.
I mean, he definitely has expectations.
As prison. Opposed to sexpectations? I'm just kidding. That's a really bad joke.
Well, he probably does have those too, which is why he says he's not a dog.
Oh, Lord. Wait, John has sexpectations or Jamie does?
Jamie.
Oh, okay. Great. I almost just said great. Oh, my Lord.
It's all right. You did the whole thing with the brogue, kind of, about 10
I did not.
Ago.
I did not.
Yes, you did.
I did not.
Go back and listen to it later when you talk about him saying he's no a dog.
I did not say
you
that.
You did. You did.
Summer, there's a T. It's not a dog.
Well, then it was the rest of that sentence. You'll hear it. Just go back and listen.
Gray apologizes and asks him to come closer to the hearth. He feels his sleeve and realizes it's wet. Now, I love it when Diana writes like this. Quote, yes, I am wet, Jamie said with elaborate patience. Sorry. I don't know, that made me laugh. Lord John's like, you can't blame him too much because he is removed from the situation, but like he had no clue that Jamie was in the storeroom. He had no clue that he had been doused with water. But Jamie's like, I'm sure he's standing there looking like looking like a drowned rat. And John's like, oh, but you're wet. Like he's so surprised. Dirt. Huh?
He's like, of course I'm wet. Right.
Exactly. John evidently hadn't ordered the guards to douse him with water and leave him in a freezing cell. And John was, to his credit, was angry that this had been done to him. Now, Lord John tries again to find out the reason for Jamie's escape. But Jamie is mum. Diana writes, quote, the little major was pacing up and down the hearth before him, unquote.
Or the not so the little major, as David Barry will play him.
Yeah, the little major is awesome. Yeah, David Barry sure ain't little. Mm-mm. So Gray knew he was justified to order all manner of things to be done to Jamie, but also that if he did, his chances of recovering the gold were all but nil. Jamie's escape proved to him at least that the gold did exist, or something happened, something with the gold or something with the situation provoked him to escape and do something. And he realized he must pursue an acquaintance with Jamie, just what Corey had said, actually, if he wanted to find out about the gold. And so he goes forth and makes a move that will forever change their combined destinies. He invites Jamie to have supper with him the next evening in his quarters. Now, Jamie was startled, but of course he said yes. Joe B. writes, both men, again, used language in their encounters, first on the moor, quote, "You have me at a disadvantage, Major," unquote, and then back at the prison, where Jamie refuses to share his reason for escape, and John picks up on the distinction in Jamie's choice of words, quote, "cannot or will not," unquote. And he says, "It doesn't seem a useful distinction." Now, Lord John needs the Frenchman's gold. It's his way out of Ardsmuir and back into the fold with all forgiven. So he tries another tack. Rather than a physical punishment, he invites Jamie to dinner. And Lisa T. writes, "This scene reveals so much about Lord John's character. We have been dreading Jamie's punishment. We know that Lord John had revenge fantasies. We have also seen Jamie as a prisoner be tortured and flogged by BJR. Lord John's honest concern for Jamie and horror at what the guards did to him is almost more of a shock than the punishment. Lord John is truly an honorable man." Then we're given a date, finally. It's March 7th, 1755, which is actually the next evening. Jamie was brought down to the room, and Gray arrived after him. Jamie, cleanly shaven, was deeply engrossed in a novel, Nouvelle Héloïse. This surprised Gray. Jamie said that he could indeed read, and John realized that he had assumed that he was illiterate. John.
He assumed everyone was illiterate.
Pretty much. He had been telling the men, Jamie had, the story of Nouvelle Héloïse, but he wanted to refresh his memory of how it ended. He again educates Gray. He tells him that all Scottish children are taught to read, but they still have a thriving oral tradition in the Highlands. And then comes the dinner. So the next time they ate together, Gray had the chessboard set up. Jamie was again surprised, but he agreed to play. Now, this allowed them to get used to each other without the pressure of finding things to talk about. This time during dinner, they at least had a little more open conversation, though Gray still did not mention the gold. And thus began their tradition of date night. Gray took it easy, but when he even hinted at the period of time of the 3 days Jamie had been gone, silence. By the way, I did not mention it last time, and I was surprised that neither any of the contributors did, because I'm usually caught out when I do forget something, or people, you know, kindly remind me. But Jamie was gone for 3 days. Now, please tell me, Summer, we've talked about this enough in other books. What does this represent?
Gilligan's Island.
Oh, come on.
The you're Holy Trinity. I mean, that's the all well, you're little, you only.
You're a little bit close. You're a little bit closer. Someone goes away for 3 days and comes back.
Oh, Easter.
Pretty much.
The resurrection. Is that where we're going with that?
I mean, yes.
I mean, I knew it was going to be biblical, or else you wouldn't be mentioning it.
Yes.
Okay.
And Jamie has been like Christ figure since Outlander. Gray does find out, however, that Jamie had spent 2 years in France working in the wine business before the rebellion. Jamie's amused, but takes care to lead topics away from the personal and go more toward the cultural. Gray, too, had spent some time in Paris, he learns. And he asks, Gray does, if he'd seen the works of Voltaire. Jamie's all, "Yeah, we entertained Monsieur Arouet. You know Voltaire's real name. Hashtag take that, Gray. Hashtag name dropping."
He's becoming that guy who constantly has to one-up you at parties. It's like where you go and you're like, "Oh my God, last week I had the worst meal at this sushi restaurant." And the guy's like, "Oh, I can top that." What do they call them? Toppers? One-uppers? It's like,
wait, is Lord John, a topper?
No. Jamie's clearly the topper here.
Sorry.
But he's just like, "Oh, well, I can top that. I had sushi once that was so bad that blah, blah, blah." It's like that, where they have an equal story that will top yours and you never win. And I feel like Jamie just like one up topped him.
Speaking of top that or toppers, whatever. What does that remind you of? There's that song in that 80s movie. Is it Teen Witch?
It's Teen Witch. I knew you were going to do that.
Oh, you did. I don't know how the song goes.
It's
but
a rap. It's not a song.
I know.
It's a rap. It's called Top That.
I know, but it's about, it might be called Top That, but the part, the song or the whatever, the performance of that thing starts with, or it has part in it that goes, "Every something needs a popular girl." That's part of that too.
No.
It is. Not I promise that. You. He's taking it around. It is. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, Top That. You top that. So, oh, wait, is okay. It truly a different song?
It's a rap.
Wait, what did you just... I know it's a rap. Song, top rap, that. What the heck? Hang I don't care. On.
Let me find your top that lyrics. I can literally hear it in my head right now because I've watched it fairly recently. I'm so not rapping this out loud, but they do not say anything about a popular girl.
From what I see is, top that, top that. You can do all you can do, but you'll never top that. Top that, top that. You can try until you blow, but you'll never top that. That's the first whatever. But now, and that may not be the right rhythm, but I mean, supersonic, idiotic, disconnected, not respected. Oh, well, it's very interesting.
That's the girl section. The whole first section was the dude kind of rapping against a car with his buddies. And then after Louise does a little spell on her little shy friend who has a crush on the little rapper dude, she like struts up, drops her bike, struts up and just starts laying down what are not, in fact, sick beats. But at the time, everyone was like, oh, my God, little curly haired white girl is rapping. It was bad. But it is a pretty iconic scene in that movie.
I found both Popular Girl and
there is a song called Popular Girl, but this is a different song.
I know.
Isn't that I want to be the most popular girl.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, and that's right. Okay, it's actually a song. And the guy who does have the big boombox that walks around, he goes off and says, da-da-da-da-da-da, every popular boy or something needs a popular girl. Going to see some major changes coming over me. Going to see major changes coming over me. I'm going to take the dream into a fantasy. I'm going to change the dream into a real fantasy. I'm going to be the most popular girl. Okay, let me see. There we go. Okay, the dude comes up and says, we would like you to come into our world. Popular girl, my life has now begun because every cool guy needs a popular girl. So come into the world. Okay, that is so wrong, but I was right that it has that line in it. Okay, so it's the rapper dude that sings that or whatever. So we'll include links to the YouTube videos of Popular Girl and Top That for Teen Witch, just because we can.
Because you all should have to remember it like I do.
So we find out that while Jamie is enjoying the mutton, Monsieur Arouet wouldn't have. He was a, quote, wee scrap of a man, unquote, and a, quote, martyr to the indigestion, unquote. Poor dude.
What, they discussed, he just ate biscuits and drank ale?
Is that something like that, yeah. My goodness. They discuss how his manner or character may have influenced his plays. And this is, of course, Voltaire still. And I love the description that Diana gives us through Jamie about the writing of novels. Quote, it's a cannibal's art in which one often mixed small portions of one's friends and one's enemies together, seasoned them with imagination, and allowed the whole to stew together into a savory concoction, unquote. And then they went on to romances. Joe B. writes, March 1955, and the routine of weekly dinners has established. As has some semblance of regard, they talk of French novels and literary society, play chess, and manage the affairs of the prison, both finding the other to be an honorable man. Lord John, respecting Jamie and not pressing for more details of his escape, but for his reason of return, he doesn't want to poke the bear without a big enough stick, and Jamie using his sense of humor to answer, a sign of his comfort with someone, yet not actually tell him the true reason. Respect and secrets coexist. Again, this comes up, right? Jamie and Claire, book one. There are room for secrets, but no lies. Lisa T. writes, I love Jamie, thinking of Lord John as the wee major. We now begin to understand why Jamie escaped after hearing the Wanderer's story. And of course, that's still coming up. April 2nd. So we've gone, what, a few weeks now? April 2nd, 1755. Gray receives a packet of quills. Quote, an unsubtle reminder that his correspondence was in arrears. Of course, from his mama. He dashes off a note to his brother, Hal, that the trip to the inn, the Wanderer, and Fraser's escape. He describes the trip to the inn, the Wanderer, and Fraser's escape. He says that it's possible Fraser may not have found the treasure. Gray had finally asked him a different question. Why had he come back? Jamie smiled and replied, quote, I suppose I must value the company, Major. I can tell you it's not the food, unquote. And then later on, Gray asked himself why he had returned. He realized there would have been an inquiry into Fraser's family connections, and thus his intent wasn't to escape, period. It was to take care of something and then return. He writes his brother that thus far he hadn't gotten any closer to an answer regarding the treasure, but there was one more avenue he had thought of. can't do anything officially yet. It's too early. So he implores his brother to look into Jamie's family.
He's going to play dirty.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. May 15th, 1755. After this most recent dinner, they get down to brass tacks. Some of the men have been ill. There were 60 who were ill, 15 of them very ill. As a talented negotiator, Jamie knew that while he wanted to ask for some things for the men, he wouldn't get everything he asked for. So he had to leave some room in the list for Gray to reject a few things. Meanwhile, Gray is ready to try his new thing. But slow and steady, he must take it one step at a time. Jamie is almost able to get the sick men another ration of meat. But Gray declines, and then Jamie asks him if the men may hunt for themselves. Jamie asks if they may set snares, and Gray approves. He had also managed to get extra peat cutters so the men could work an extra half hour per day, the extra peat to provide a small fire in each cell. There were no medicines, but he had a connection to a chemist and said that if he would agree to send them, they could have the medicines. So now Gray was ready to get down to his biz. Gray has Hal's letter in his pocket. He asks Jamie, quote, "How does your sister fare these days?" Unquote. "Oopsie, Gray, thou knowest not what thou doest." Now, actually, he does know what he's doing.
He's like poking a sleeping bear.
Thank you.
I don't think he could.
Careful now, dude.
I don't think Jamie could be any more timid than he is.
Timid?
Prior to that, like, he's very genteel. Like, he's being, I don't think he could have been more genteel with him. But yeah, okay. The second he flips it like that and he's like, okay, this isn't working, I'm going to try a new tactic, I'm like, you picked the wrong one, dude.
Oh, gosh.
Don't threaten his family.
Jamie's face turns white with shock. Gray mentions Lallybroch. Keep it up, Gray. Just keep it up. And then he says, like, he just cannot stop. He goes, "I dare say they do very well these days, what with the gold you have provided them," unquote. And then he mentions Ian. Now Jamie says, well, since Lallybroch is 100 miles away, how in the heck would I have gotten there and back in 3 days? Now Gray suggests he may have met someone. And he thinks Jamie is hiding something from him, which of course he is. But he says that he can't trust his word. Jamie reminds him that he kept his word 100%. Regarding the trip to the inn. And one of Jamie's hands curls into a fist. And then he relaxes it. He says, yes, he did not meet anyone on the moor. Then Gray pulls out his trump card. It really doesn't matter whether or not he actually communicated with his family. The mere possibility that he could have is enough to send a party of dragoons to Lallybroch and search it and arrest and interrogate his family. Then he mentions all of the people at Lallybroch. Dude, Gray Boy, Simadana. He keeps on keeping on, however. Quote, "The three eldest children are old enough to be arrested and interrogated with their parents, you know. Such interrogations are frequently ungentle, Mr. Fraser." Unquote. He's lucky he's got a tongue.
What?
He's lucky he's got a tongue in his head. He just won't shut the shut up.
No, he's not lucky.
He's lucky he has a tongue that Jamie didn't tear it out. No,
he's lucky that Jamie is unarmed. Laughing? He's lucky
he has fingers.
He's lucky. I didn't say unfingered. I said unarmed. He's lucky
unarmed, but his fingers can be. And Summer, don't be facetious.
My point is that Jamie is unarmed in many ways. He's unarmed because he doesn't physically have a weapon, and he is rather helpless in this situation. He does not have recourse. The information is already out there. As far as he knows, John has already ordered the people to go and search Lallybroch.
That's true. That's true.
So he is completely
bluffing or not
at the mercy
of this little major.
Of the tiny major.
The tiny major. That's better. Then Jamie, knowing he is defeated, asks, quote, "What do you want of me?" unquote. And Gray says he wants the truth. Jamie gives him the truth. Now, what he didn't tell him was that some of what the man said had personal meaning to him. He mentioned his wife and that she was gone. Now, he never said she was dead. He tells him, Gray, about Claire. Quote, "My wife was a healer, what they call in the Highlands a charmer. But more than that, she was a white lady, a wise woman," unquote. A witch. So Jamie said he thought the man might be referring to his wife. And if he was, he absolutely had to go see. He went to a spot. It was a shrine to Saint Bride, also called a white lady. There was nothing there to do with Claire, though. She truly was gone. He did, however, find the gold. He said it was gold, but not French coin. The small box had contained gold and silver coins and a small leather pouch filled with jewels, and he had no idea of their provenance. And la-di-da, by the way, yeah, I just, you know, can't be bothered. I just threw them into the sea. Now, it happened to be at the very spot they were searching. It was in the sea, but it was near where they were on the cliffs or whatever. It was at the Devil's Cauldron, which has already been written about. He didn't see any use for the treasure, nor did he want it to go to King Geordie. So he threw it in the sea.
I can just imagine Lord John's face, like his eyes. Face, just
I
like,
know. He's like,
are you kidding me? Gray says that while it's a moving story, there's no evidence that it's the truth. And Jamie finds this amusing. He says, but there actually is. Then he reaches into the waistband of his breeches and brings out a sapphire. Now, I want to know, was it in the back of the breeches? In the front? Because that thing had to be hidden somewhere, unless he had a pocket. Did he get it out of his backside?
I mean, he's not keeping it tucked in his butt. I'm sure that he's got, must have a little pocket or like someplace. I mean, a butt is not a good pocket. It's not.
Sure,
I mean,
it is.
No, not for easy retrieval.
Sure it is, if it's just a little bit inside.
Why do you know this for a fact?
I don't know it for a fact. I'm
are
just
you a
saying,
drug mule?
Summer.
Do you smuggle things in your bum? Are you a bum smuggler?
Enough. No. Jamie kept the sapphire in case once he were freed, he might send it to his family. Of course, they couldn't make use of a whole bunch of stuff without drawing lots of attention. I mean, maybe even one would have been pushing it. But for future possibilities, he kept it with him. And just how did he keep it with him? Of course, he swallowed it. After he as soon as he said this, Gray puts the sapphire back down. You don't find that funny?
No.
After he says, I swallowed it and it came out of my booty, Gray puts it down.
Oh, that. I'm surprised he put it down.
Oh.
But he's not enamored yet. It's coming, but he's not enamored yet.
Gray asks him to swear on the Bible that he was telling the truth. Jamie does so. He swears that, quote, the treasure is as I told you, unquote, and that it, quote, rests now in the sea, unquote. Eileen P. writes, Lord John's naivete is revealed when trying to match Jamie the chess master. Lord John is not Jamie's level. He does not have the ability to think of all possible outcomes in order to negotiate effectively. Jamie outsmarts Lord John by being able to keep his word as a man of honor and yet outwit him. Well played, Jamie. However, by interacting with Jamie, Lord John ups his own game. In time, he figures out why Jamie allowed himself to be captured after escaping and uses that as leverage. Touché. Or should I say, check, Lord John. Joe B. writes, Lord John is using his own formidable resources to get some leverage on Jamie. Once he has his weapon, he uses it. It's only by threatening his family that Jamie will tell John and us why he escaped. Language, again, is important in this conversation, where Jamie defends his keeping the letter of the law, if not the spirit. It's when John questions his honor that we see the return of a defiant Jamie. He hasn't told anybody else what the man said. He said he told John a truthful account, and he escaped neither on the way to or from the inn where they met the wanderer. What he didn't tell John was that he recognized the man, and the story told. Perhaps surprisingly for John, but not for us, Jamie's primary reason isn't the treasure, but Claire. Was there a chance his white lady is still alive? That alone was reason enough for escape. Secondly, the treasure. Was it the gold promised during the rising that may have turned their fortunes? It wasn't Claire, and it wasn't gold. It was, however, treasure. Jamie produces proof by way of a sapphire, and we know this comes back into the story much later. And in an act of
hopefully
last...
Hopefully in a very different manner.
And in an act of last rebellion, tells John he left it in the sea. If he, who took the risk to find it, can't use it, neither should the king who has imprisoned him. Finally, Lisa T. Jamie is finally able to share his thoughts and feelings about Claire. This is the first time he has shared so much about her. It's perhaps the first time that the two of them are comfortable enough with each other to share a humorous moment. Their chess games are a metaphor for their relationship. They try to figure each other out. First, they are worthy adversaries, but often at an impasse. Lord John thinks he has won when he gets the story from Jamie, but doubts it. When Jamie presents the sapphire, it is checkmate. Jamie has not only won the game, but also Lord John's friendship and respect. And that's chapter 10.
Join us next week when we discuss chapter 11, entitled, and forgive me if I'm incorrect in saying this, Tora Molino's Gambit. See, just when I thought I was going to be free of these words I can't pronounce, they threw this in. Thanks, Diana.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to
thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/outlanderpod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/outlanderpod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.